I told those who were at Bible study today that if my phone rings, it just means that I'm over 50. I got a new phone this week. I haven't figured out yet how to turn it on silence. Now, I could have left my phone back in my seat, but the consequence of that might have been that I wouldn't have had a clock, and since all of you are so attentive and alert, we might just keep going on and on, so I'm risking taking a phone. I have no idea whether or not it is on ring or whether it is on silent, so I'm just giving you advance warning if that happens. Such a pleasure that all of you are with us this afternoon on a truly meaningful weekend. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time going through some things regarding Thanksgiving, and I did that in the Bible study, so if you have interest in that, you can see it online very shortly. But this is, as we say, a truly American holiday. Now, if you could possibly challenge that, because there are other countries and cultures that celebrate Thanksgiving days. In Germany, they have what is called an Erntedankfest. There are harvest festivals all over the world. But I think when we say that Thanksgiving is a truly American holiday, it has a lot to do with the fact that it dates back to, in our case, 1621, and is part and parcel to and connected intrinsically with the founding of our nation. Pilgrims flee European oppression, as they called it, to find freedom in a new homeland. Great risks are undertaken, long voyages endured, hardship is taken into consideration, great sacrifice is made, faith is expressed in the actions taken to acquire a new homeland. And all of us have our own story, but I will share mine. We were just in Germany for the Feast of Tabernacles and visited the homestead, if you can call it that, of my grandmother, Raber. Now, we just found this out. They actually occupied and leased a castle. Yes, a castle that is 240 feet long, four stories high, from a period of 1821 to 1837. Before they auctioned off everything that they owned, and the records indicate that they, after doing so, they were actually quite well to do, they had two baskets of silver coins. Now, I have no idea how much that would be, but it would be a small fortune which they needed, because passage to the United States at that time cost roughly the equivalent, a one-way ticket as it were, cost roughly the equivalent of a year's wages. So Christian and Jacob Raber, along with their children, a total of 20 in number between the two families, immigrated to the United States, and one of them settled near my home in Sugar Creek, Ohio. And it's, you know, yesterday we were reminiscing with my uncle, the Raber homestead, one of them, there are several, depending on which generation you look at, is about 5 miles from my home. And when I drove by yesterday, actually, I looked at this homestead and compared it to the castle from whence they had come. And it is a completely different structure. And instead of Lake Constance right in front of their house, 200 feet away, you have a measly little creek flowing down. And I tried to imagine what that change must have been, what they left behind to come here in the foreboding wilderness that the United States and the Ohio country at that time was. Why did they do that? Well, I hope to answer some of that in a sermon entitled Finding Freedom on the Frontier of faith. That is the title of the sermon this afternoon. Write it down. Finding freedom on the frontier of faith. Because in this particular case, the title is more than a title. It is actually the thesis and the topic that we will look into, and it consists of seven words. Finding freedom on the frontier of faith. These seven words capture the essence of the quest for freedom. As I mentioned, you know, write them down. And then I have a little assignment for you as soon as you get them copied down, because they capture the essence of the quest of freedom. And once you've written it down, I want to analyze with you the meaning of these words. So you've written down the seven words, finding freedom on the frontier of faith. So I'd like you to do this. Take a pencil, and yes, for those of you that have smartphones and take notes on smartphones, I'm expecting you to write it down as well. And then you can take these fancy graphic things and do in your smartphone what you can do with your pencil as well. Take and draw a square around the word freedom and faith. And then after you've done that, I'd like you to draw a circle around finding and frontier. Because these words connect and they actually come around, and I've quantified it and analyzed it into what I've called four distinctive truisms that teach us about the dynamics of freedom and faith. Faith and freedom are intrinsically connected. You cannot have one without the other. And finding such freedom is often full of challenges. So here are the four truisms. Number one, there can be no freedom without faith. There can be no freedom without faith. Number two, faith is always a frontier in an unconquered land of promise. Faith is always a frontier in an unconquered land of promise. And then an interesting thing happens. It is on this frontier beyond the wasteland of fear that freedom may be found. And then finally we circle around to the fourth truism, which is very similar to the first. And that is that there can also be no active, authentic faith without corresponding freedom. One is a result, shall we say, of the other. So let's take a look at truism number one. There can be no freedom without faith. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 is the quintessential faith chapter. If there can be no freedom without faith, then I think it is important that we define faith. And Hebrews does that for us over in chapter 1 of Hebrews 11, and it simply states, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." Now if you take a look at that, it's a little bit philosophical. Although the sermonette did a good job in bringing some practical application to it. But take a look at this verse a little bit closer. When we look at faith as the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen, it may at first seem, like I said, a bit philosophical, except that what is not meant here, and this I want to emphasize, what is not meant here is that faith is something that can't be understood, that it is something that is maybe a feeling or a belief without action. It is rather a confidence that is built on truth that is sure, that we find revealed in the pages of the Bible. And with that basis, you can go forward with confidence, as did the elders in verse 3. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. Now, I believe Paul wrote this, and at the time he did this, not as much was known about the creation as we know today. And science has different theories, but whatever the case, we see here that what we see, God created out of nothing. I mean, that's a mind-bending situation. Then dropping down to verse 6, but without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. We had a sermon a couple of weeks ago where we simply looked at the fact that God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And what we learned in that, I think, is important, because it doesn't say that God is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him, simply that he is a rewarder. Now, don't misunderstand me. What I am not saying is that God is not ultimately the rewarder and the cause behind all good things. What we draw from it, or drew from it in that sermon, was simply that if we live by faith, meaning living by and believing God and doing the things that we know to be true in the Bible, there is a sequence of events, natural law, if you will, that causes rewards to occur. So faith is not an irrational idea. It is rather something that is true and based on God's word that we can count on with confidence. And that is what I believe caused people to take such great risk in order to come to the United States to be able to exercise what was the most important thing to them at that time, and that was their faith in God. And it was that faith that produced freedom. I'd like to read a couple of quotes from this book, Liberty's Secrets, page number 16. Here we have Adams commenting on the bleak scene of Europe. Now again, these things are all a matter of perspective. If you were among the noblemen in Europe, the United States would have appeared bleak. And having visited my family's homeland and toured the actual structure where they lived, and then comparing that to the wilderness of Ohio, if you were focused on material things, the land to which they emigrated no doubt would have appeared bleak. Here is Adams commenting on a bleak scene painted by history, particularly in Europe. And he said, quote, "Shall we conclude from these melancholy observations that human nature is incapable of liberty, freedom, that no honest equality can be preserved in society, and that such forcible causes are always at work and must reduce all men to a submission to despotism, monarchy, or aristocracy?" You see, for him, the bleakness was not in how much you possessed, but rather in the freedoms that you enjoyed. His response, by no means. This all began to change with the opening of the Bible to the commoner for the first time after the Reformation. Upon reading it, the Puritans and many other dissenters didn't see the idea that some men were more equal than others, but that all men were equal before God, a contention they and their progeny, the founders, would stake all their claims to liberty upon. Nowhere did they see God treating kings one way and treating everybody else another way. I mean, if you look at men, this is how people and men and rulers interact. They treated different classes differently depending on their standing. The underlying basis for the freedom that we have enjoyed for the last 200 years or so, or 394, depending on when you start counting, or more than that, depending on when you start counting, finds its basis in this notion, this Reformation, this opening of the Bible to the commoners that previously was not possible. You know, we carry the Bible in our pockets, in our hands, on our cell phones, in the internet. I mean, it is unthinkable today to not have this information available to us. And perhaps we too often take it for granted. But when people began reading and began understanding that rights were given by God and that all men are equal before God, it changed things. Continuing, Thomas Paine in his famous pamphlet, Common Sense, derided this idea, not from humanistic or secular grounds, but from the Bible. Can you imagine a politician today arguing, or a lawyer today arguing from the basis of the Bible? This is what Thomas Paine did. Quote, as exalting one man, the king, so greatly above the rest cannot be justified on the equal rights of nature, so neither can it be defended by the authority of Scripture. Since all were equal before God, all shared the same inherent rights, Adams had written a decade earlier, for such they have undoubtedly, antecedent to all earthly governments, rights that cannot be repealed or restrained by human laws, rights derived from the great legislator of the universe. So we come back to the truism that I cited, that there can be no freedom without a basis in faith. You know, the very rights that we ascribe to, the humanistic idea, cannot be long sustained. I have another quote here that I'd like to read that I think makes an important point. It was written by the Archbishop of Philadelphia this year, and he says something interesting about the basis of our democracy. Liberal democracy doesn't have the resources to sustain its own purpose. Democracy depends for its meaning on the existence of some higher authority outside itself. You know, if human beings are, as he stated, and I'll read it in a minute, simply another grouping of animals, human rights and animal rights will be on the same footing. And, I mean, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out where that heads, which direction that heads down to. It will head to tyranny very quickly. The biggest problem we face as a culture isn't gay marriage or global warming, even though we're told repeatedly that global warming is a bigger threat than terrorism, which I find to be rather humorous. And here's why. You can't predict the weather for next week, but you know that the oceans are going to be 10 feet higher in 2050. You know why you can make that prediction? Because by the time you get to 2050, nobody will remember what you predicted. But I find it interesting that he states that it's not gay marriage or global warming. It's not abortion funding or federal debt. These are vital issues, clearly, but the deeper problem, the one that is crippling us, is that we use words like justice, rights, freedom, and dignity without any commonly shared meaning to their contents. The difference that we have in our multicultural society that we find ourselves in 2015 is that we do not have the same common understanding that they had back in the day when the first Thanksgiving was established. There was a diversity of opinion and denominational differences, but they all believed universally in an almighty and all-powerful God to whom they owed their existence and were willing to brave the oceans wide in little ships in order to live that in a land of freedom. We speak the same language, but words don't mean the same thing. Our public discourse never gets to what is true and what isn't because it can't. Our most important debates boil out to who can deploy the best words in the best way to get power. Does that ring true? You know, it's about sound bites. It's about who can say something that sounds really good instead of getting down to the heart of the matter. Words like justice have emotional throw weight, so people use them as weapons. And it can't be otherwise because the religious vision and convictions that once animated American life are no longer welcome at the table. After all, what can human rights mean if science sees nothing transcendent in the human species? When we get to that point, we risk the very freedom that we have enjoyed and celebrate Thanksgiving over, although Thanksgiving today is something very different from what it was in 1621. I mentioned it in the Bible study. This is why I need my cell phone. I did some research and I found a sermon. Dateline December 12, 1621. It is 17 typed pages long. Now, I don't know how long that would take to read it, but I dare say more than an hour. And, you know, here is the topic that this certain pastor found to be necessary in Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1621. He titled it The Sin and Danger of Self-Love, taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 24. An entire sermon was preached around what was called a dehortation, I'd never heard that word before, so I learned a new word, and an exhortation. From Paul's epistle to the Corinthian church, let no man seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. And when you drop that into the context of the 50 surviving pilgrims, it gives a perhaps a new understanding or a deeper understanding of the plight in which they found themselves back then. Another quote from the book Liberty, just to, again, emphasize the point that the freedoms that we enjoy have their basis in faith. And a truism is this: without faith, there can be no freedom. Tyrants through the ages have given this question a firm no, for only kings had divinely endowed rights. The founders, however, said yes, for they believe, as did their Puritan ancestors, that all men are divinely endowed with rights, but they also believe that liberty was possible only if the assertion of such rights were accompanied by a like assertion of the moral and rational faculties with which to exercise those rights for the benefit of themselves and others. Now today, it is widely believed that freedom is somehow synonymous with being able to do whatever I want to do, and that is often with the small addendum, as long as it does not hurt someone else. They understood freedom in a very different way, because they fled oppression, as they saw it, in Europe. Notice, people had a right to worship God as they desired because they had a duty to worship God. So when you follow that logic, they were duty-driven to worship God. And since it was the duty of man to worship God, it follows logically that they also had a divine right to the freedom to do so as they understood. You know, this is why people would leave a castle, pack their bags, load what they had in wagons, drive all the way across, in my family's case, France, to board a ship to Philadelphia to settle in Charm, Ohio, if you know where that is. And if you don't, it is a really small place. It's a very different perspective from what our culture asserts today. Freedom defined as not only a right, but a duty to worship God, as opposed to freedom to do whatever I want to do, as long as it allegedly doesn't hurt other people. So we might test that concept with the latest news. You know, it's amazing what is news. Charlie Sheen. Now, Charlie Sheen, I didn't really know who he was until the news broke that he is HIV positive. And I'm sure that he felt that this was freedom at its best. And now he has infected who knows how many people with the virus. That is a huge departure from the freedoms that the founders and the Puritans and the Sabbath keepers and all the other people that came from Europe with great expense and sacrifice. It's a very different freedom than what they knew. Going back to, people had a right to worship God as they desired because they had a duty to worship God as well as they knew how. They had the right to speak their minds because they had a duty to use their minds in pursuit of productive ends, and they had the right to their property because they had the duty to acquire it honestly and steward it wisely. Citizens who utilize their liberty in such ways as to govern themselves do not require an impersonal, removed, and ponderous government to tell them, let alone compel them to do what they already know and compel themselves to do. This was, in a nutshell, the liberty our founders believed worth dying for. it is still worth dying for today. Truism number one that we find in the statement, finding freedom on the frontier of faith, is that there can be no freedom without faith. As we depart from those foundations, our liberties will, as a natural consequence, be infringed upon. Because what we just read was, people that are dedicated to faith, even a misunderstanding or a lack of a full comprehension of the Christian faith, do not need much government. But when you depart from that, government is required to prevent bad things from happening, and there can never be enough government to prevent bad things from happening, so you turn into a police state. Because, as the truism says, there can be no freedom without faith. Truism number two. Faith is always a frontier in an unconquered land of promise. And again, I mean, I speak interchangeably of country, of organization, of individual freedom, because the basis of all freedom, the basis of all of these things are the same. So you can have in your mind's eye a frontier of faith that is in an unconquered land of promise on an individual basis. And you can exercise and live in that space. And I would submit to you that if we exercise faith properly, that we will always be on that frontier. We will never quite find ourselves at ease. And neither should we, because it is in that ease that faith is often lost. It is on the frontier where there are challenges, and yet there is promise and there is hope, that our faith is often at its greatest strength. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. Actually, we're already there. Hebrews chapter 11. And notice Abraham, the father of the faithful, in connection to this truism. Abraham exercised his faith on a frontier in an unconquered land of promise. Verse 8. By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would afterward receive as an inheritance. When Abraham acted on the call, when he believed God and left, he was on a frontier. The land as yet was unconquered, because it says here that he would receive it afterward as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, by that belief, he sojourned in the land of promise in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. They were pioneering. They were migrating through the promised land. And yet they look forward to, as it says here in verse 10, for he waited for the city which has a foundation, whose builder and maker is God. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 12 and just take a look at what Moses recorded in Genesis in this regard. Genesis chapter 12, and of course this is written in a very concise manner. I'm sure that there was a lot more discussion and dialogue between God and Abraham than what is here recorded. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So we see here that Abraham left to an unconquered land, but there was a promise that he would only see fulfilled in a small part. You know, faith gives us that ability to live in that space. You know, the confidence that we can have through the truth of God enable us to do things that others can't. I attended a presentation by leadership guru John Maxwell a couple of weeks ago. And there were a number of presentations. I was in a smaller group of people that he spoke to earlier. And in that group, he mentioned something. He said, early in my life, I read the book of Acts every day. And I assume he meant that he read in the book of Acts every day as opposed to reading the whole of the book of Acts, to try to learn, as he put it, what were some of the defining characteristics of these people? You know, what was it about the New Testament church that made it so dynamic, and what were some of those things? And one of the conclusions he came to that I found was worthy of noting was that the one thing these people had in common, the 12 apostles and the church, was that they were living beyond their capability. They were living beyond their capability. And I thought, now that's interesting. You know, you had 12 fishermen. Well, most of them were fishermen. But relatively uneducated men that because they believed the gospel and they had seen what Jesus Christ had done and they believed what he would do, they were able to do what otherwise would have been impossible. And that is to carry the gospel to the known world. I'd like to, in this connection, faith is always a frontier in an unconquered land of promise. Again, read another quote. This is the sermon of quotes. Page number 128. And again, this goes back to the idea that we cited earlier, that it was not until the advent and the free publication of the Bible, or the widespread publication, it wasn't free, that some of these ideas of freedom were able to come forth. I'm sure much to the chagrin and desperation of those who were in charge. Had not the Roman government permitted inquiry, Christianity could not have been introduced. So there was a measure of freedom during the early church, but very quickly that was clamped down, but it didn't stop the gospel. Had not inquiry been indulged in the era of the Reformation, the corruption of Christianity could not have been purged away. If it be restrained now, the present corruptions will be protected and new ones encouraged. The idea was, with the freedom of the press, that ideas would come forward and that the good ideas would be able to stand on their substance, and that ideas that didn't hold water would eventually get purged. As Madison put it, we are teaching the world the great truth that governments do better without kings and nobles than with them. The merit will be doubled by the other lesson that religion flourishes in greater purity without than with the aid of government. That was the idea way back then that inspired people to come here. You know, we had, and again, I go back and I said, everybody has their story, I cite mine. So you went from being the only Anabaptist in an otherwise Catholic town, and even though you lived in the castle, much to the chagrin of the local Catholics, and it's recorded in the documentations, they were not very well liked, to leave all of that in the quest, in the simple quest to go to an unconquered land of promise to live out the freedom to be able to exercise the duty and the freedom to worship God in the best way I understood. That is a very different freedom from supposing that we have a right to do whatever I want to do. He went further in a letter to another friend, quote, "Rival sects with equal rights exercise mutual censorship in favor of good morals, and no doubt exist that there is much more of religion among us now than there ever was before the change. This proves that law is not necessary to support religion if you have the free exercise thereof." So that brings us to truism number 3. It is on this frontier, beyond the wasteland of fear, that freedom is found. You know, when I look at, again, going back to my family story, if I look at what they came to in 1837 in the wilderness of Ohio and Iowa and Missouri, and as the story goes, you know, one of the sons lived in Missouri during the Civil War. Before the Civil War, he had 600 branded cattle. After the war, he had none. Both armies availed themselves to beef, but they had freedom, something that they did not have in a land back in Europe where the law dictated how you exercised your duty to God and King to worship. Quote, "The Puritans sought out a land so rough and so neglected and so," this is my embellishment, "and so far away from castle and king, that they might be allowed to live there as they wished and to worship God without restriction. They tore themselves away from the comforts of their native land to obey a purely intellectual need. By suffering the inevitable deprivations of exile, their object was the triumph of an idea, and that idea was freedom." You know, what strikes me in looking at this sermon is how language is used today. We text it. You know, you manage to get your message across in 20 characters or less. Texts, tweets. And, you know, I've been long concerned that we have lost the capacity to write coherent paragraphs. And I wonder if the sentence is next in line. Let me read you a sentence from this. This is 1621. And remember, we didn't have Google. We didn't have a Bible search engine. And notice with what ease this author is able to make his case, even though the sentence is a paragraph long. The sermon is very well organized. He has doctrine one and doctrine two and point one and point two and objection one and answer two. And, you know, it just goes through and boom, 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 answers the objections. The doctrine one is enumerated as, and the English is a little bit old, all men are too apt and ready to seek themselves too much, and to prefer their own matters and causes beyond the due of lawful measure, even to excess and offense against God, yea, danger of their own souls. So that's the problem. That's why he felt it was necessary to preach the sermon in 1621, because someone among the 50 pilgrims was indulging themselves. And then he makes an argument citing biblical examples, and I just ask you to pay attention with what ease he was able to cite these, even though he didn't have a search engine to find it, nor a keyboard to type it out. And this is not only true in wicked men, which are given over of God to vile lusts. Okay, this is not just a problem with the bad guys, as, and then he cites the examples, the biblical ones, as Absalom in getting favor in his father's court, Jeroboam in settling his kingdom fast in Samaria, Ahab in vehement seeking Naboth's vineyard. But men otherwise godly have through frailty been foiled herein, and many thousands which have shown godliness are lovers of themselves. David was about to seek himself when he was going to kill Nabal. Asa in putting Hanan in prison. Josiah when he would go to war with Necho against the counsel of God and reason. Peter when he dissembled about the ceremonies of the law, yea, and Paul complains of all his followers, except Timothy, that they sought their own too inordinately. That was, by the way, one sentence. Let's take a look at Hebrews chapter 11, verse 30. Hebrews chapter 11, in verse 30. We read of all the great conquests that the faithful of old did, and then we come down to verse 30. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. And then it says, and what more shall I say, for the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah. You know, these people finally found freedom on the frontier of faith because they had gone beyond the wasteland of fear in which the Israelites wandered for 40 years. They were always fearful of going forward in faith because they kept looking back to the wasteland. Joshua chapter 1 records when they broke through and entered the land of promise. that God had promised to Abraham hundreds of years earlier. Verse 1 of Joshua chapter 1, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise and go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, as I said to Moses. From the wilderness of this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites and the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. It is here that the Israelites finally found freedom. I mean, they no longer needed the manna. They no longer needed the cloud and the fire. They went into the promised land, and it is there that freedom was found. Notice in verse 6, be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe and do all the law which Moses my servant commanded you, and do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. It is a promise that God gave that Israel in part, was able to receive. And I say they were in part able to receive. They did not fully accept, fully conquer the land of opportunity because of a lack of faith. You had the situation, you have the walls of Jericho falling down, and then you had the situation in Ai, and then they didn't follow through in conquering all the way to the Euphrates. But it was, but the truism is still true that it was on this frontier where they found freedom. And then we come to number 4. There can be no active, authentic faith without corresponding freedom. So now we've turned the words around. When faith is active, when it is authentic, liberty will be the result. James chapter 2. James chapter 2. Beginning in verse 14. And here's where it kind of comes down to the doing. It goes from being a philosophical construct to very practical Christian living that at the end of the day is what really matters if we take Christ's words seriously from Judgment Day. Verse 14, what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says that he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or a sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, if there is no outcome, it is dead. If the way we live does not provide an outcome, it's just dead. It's not productive. if it doesn't produce anything, we need to ask ourselves the question, are we living the right way? But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. If you believe there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. And I would submit that we live in a culture in which this is not even true any longer. These people do not believe that there is a God. Even the demons do that. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. It was Abraham's action, his authentic and active faith, that caused it to be accounted to him for righteousness. Otherwise, it's dead. You know, if your brother or sister is destitute and you do not give them food, what is your answer going to be when you stand before Christ and he asks the pertinent question? I was hungry and you gave me drink. I've always found it fascinating and sobering, the questions Christ asks. He didn't ask which school we went to and, you know, how much we preached and all of the other great and mighty things that people supposedly did. At the end of the day, it came down to things, and this is the beauty of it, that anybody has the capacity to do. Active, authentic faith. Active, authentic faith will result in freedom, but it's not free. What we have enjoyed in this country for centuries is unparalleled in human history. And I fear that we take it for granted when we look at the price that was paid and the freedom that was, the sacrifices, the price that was paid and the sacrifice that was made to aspire to a freedom that we as a culture do not even recognize as such any longer. It wasn't the freedom to do whatever I want to do. It was the freedom to fulfill my duty, to worship God the best way I knew. That is what Thanksgiving is about, and we conclude over in John chapter 8. John chapter 8. Here are Christ's words on freedom. John chapter 8 and verse 30. And he spoke these words. As he spoke these words, many believed in him, Then Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Faith that is active and authentic can only be based on truth. And when we act on truth in faith, this is the kind of freedom that results. Their response was not unlike what we might encounter if we were to take a microphone and go interview people on the street. They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Even though they were under the protection and bondage of Rome at the time, Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." Brethren, finding freedom on the frontier of faith is something that we should all be seeking, whether on a national level or, more importantly, on an individual level, because a country, an organization, or a church cannot be more than the sum of its parts. There are four distinctive truisms which teach the dynamics of freedom and faith. There can be no freedom without faith. Faith is always a frontier in an unconquered land of promise, and it is in this frontier beyond the wasteland of fear that freedom is found. And finally, there can be no faith without corresponding freedom. Let's find it, let's measure it, and treasure it, because freedom, as our fathers knew it, is fast getting lost in the culture in which we live.